So we come to the second talk in our examination of the mind. And as you, of course, know, this all links in with our general theme of trying to understand, trying to know the mind, and especially to practice Dhammavicaya, that is discrimination, investigation of mental events, so that we come to see what really is going on in our minds and see it as a basis to changing it. Of course, to some extent, knowing our minds is to change them. But first of all, at least, we have to learn how to accurately assess what it is that's going on. And we saw from the Anapanasati Sutta that there are two broad kinds of categorization that are used. There are those that are more connected with ethical discrimination, and we saw that in terms of the dichotomy of skillful and unskillful, and of praiseworthy and blameworthy. But we also saw that there are epistemic categories, which are to do with the degree to which we're conscious, the extent to which our consciousness is accurate. And those are categorized in the Anapanasati Sutta in terms of dark and light. This is at least my interpretation, that presumably dark and light in the sense that as you become more conscious, well, your consciousness becomes brighter. High and low in the sense that as you become more conscious, your consciousness is more elevated. So there are these two different ways of evaluating what's going on, either as skillful or unskillful, or as more or less conscious, more or less accurately perceiving the world, knowing the world. So we're particularly concerned in this part of the retreat with the epistemic categories. We're particularly concerned with seeing how we accurately or inaccurately perceive our world, know our world, or how we see it from a less or more elevated perspective. And the two lists that are really involved with the epistemic. Can you hear me, besides, as we're in full sail on the good ship, the Dharma? The two different lists we're using, the Sarvatraga mental events and the Vinayata mental events, are primarily concerned with this. In a way, the Sarvatraga mental events are just dealing with the basic mechanics of the mind. They just show us the traditional view of what the essential elements are in every moment of consciousness. Those elements can be either skillful or unskillful. They can be more or less conscious, more or less accurate. But they're treated, first of all, simply as elements, the structural elements that make up the mind. Sarvatraga means universal or omnipresent. So that the five Sarvatraga mental events, Chaitadharmas, universal, omnipresent Chaitadharmas, accompany every citta. If you've got a citta, you've got the five Sarvatraga mental events. Indeed, in the Yogacara, you know, there are the eight Vijnanas. Well, each of the eight Vijnanas has these five omnipresent mental events accompanying it, even, you could say, constituting it. Exactly what that means is another topic, but I just mention that by way of illustrating how the tradition sees them as absolutely universal. So these five define what a moment of consciousness is. If you've got a moment of consciousness, you've got these five things. In a sense, that is what it is. You can't have consciousness without the five. We'll see just how significant this is as we go on, because we probably don't realise the extent to which every instant of consciousness contains exactly what it does contain. So although they're instantaneous and all five are present immediately together as accompaniments of every primary mind, of every citta, these Chaitadharmas accompany them. You remember we talked yesterday of the king with the ministers. Well, these five ministers are always there. So, although they're all instantaneous, they also can be seen as a kind of flow, indeed a chain. And you'll probably recognise most of them from the 12 Nidanas. And if they're not sort of explicitly correlated with links in the 12 Nidana chain, you can see how they would be fitted into it. So they are also sequential. One gives rise to the next. In quite complicated patterns, but I'm going to reduce that to a fairly simple sort of flow of one to the next. So we start with sparsha, the raw contact of sensory organ and consciousness and object. That raw contact leads on to a hedonic response, a sensation which is hedonically toned, pleasant, painful, neutral. And following on from that, it's not quite as simple as that, they're very much inter-involved, but coming on from that, and to some extent even preceding it at times, is samnya, interpretation, discrimination, recognition, labelling. And as a result of having had contact between consciousness and object, as a result of having of feelings having arisen in relation to that, of an interpretation having been made of it, desire arises. A drive is activated. Chetana comes into play. As a result of chetana coming into play, full cognition takes place. We pay attention to the object. That's manaskara. So we can see these as flowing on one from another, although, as I say, particularly with Vedana and Samnya, it's not quite an orderly flow. To some extent, your Vedana will affect your Samnya, but also your Samnya will affect your Vedana. I'll go into all of this in a minute, but I just want to, having produced beautiful clarity, muddy it all again. So we can see a sort of progression, and I'll deal with them in that progressive order. I should confess at this point this is not the way they're traditionally dealt with, although oddly enough, the traditional accounts imply this ordering. So I'm going to shamelessly follow it, and no doubt there will be articles in Shabda about it later. So they're all present at once, but they're also sequential. But that means then you've got sort of five chains, as it were, overlapping, if you see what I mean. Whilst you're having a sparsha in this moment, you're also having the Vedana coming from previous sparsha, and so on. So they're all overlapping each other, leapfrogging each other in a very complicated way. And clearly, again, we have to remind ourselves that we're breaking down something that actually is presented as a whole. We don't experience our consciousness in bits, usually. Some of us have made, in our youth, quite a lot of effort to experience our consciousness in bits, spent money on it. But actually, consciousness comes as a sort of an assembled whole, and the analysis that we're making is an intellectual one rather than an existential one, if you see what I mean, a phenomenological one. You can discern, you can imply these elements. You can't sort of experience sparsha separate from the other elements. They all come bundled up together. So it's already quite artificial, and the fact that it doesn't altogether sort of run on smoothly just adds to that impression. So yes, we're dealing with something that's organic, that's a living whole, and we're dealing with it in terms of somewhat simplified categories, but nonetheless useful ones, which will, I hope, by the end of the morning, reveal some useful insights. So let's start with sparsha, because that is really the basis for all the other consciousnesses, or all the other chaitadharmas in this sequence, and that the tradition says. So sparsha literally means touch or contact. It still does in Indian languages, and it's the touch or contact of three elements: of the sense organ, the indriya, of the object, the vishaya, and of the consciousness, the vijnana. So it's the contact of organ, object and consciousness, indriya, vishaya and vijnana. Indriya includes the five physical sense organs: eyes, ears, noses, tongues, body, yes, skin. Is that it? Yes. And also the mind, the imagination, and so on. So sparsha is not just a physical contact, despite the sort of extreme concreteness of the Sanskrit word. It includes contact of a mental kind, between the mind, considered as the organ of mental impression, and mental objects. So the objects correspond to the organ. So when the eye comes in contact with objects, they're visual objects. The ear with audible objects, and so on. And, of course, the mind with mental objects. But contact between organ and object is not enough. Well, you could see that from somebody perhaps asleep with their eyes open. So presumably light is passing from the object to their eyes and onto the retina, etc. But they're not seeing it. And that's even more graphically illustrated by a dead person. Presumably the same physical processes are taking place. But sparsha does not take place because there's no consciousness. So consciousness completes the development of sparsha. So in a way, sparsha is the easiest of the five that we're going to deal with. It's just the absolutely raw, basic contact of organ with object, as it were, in the presence of consciousness, or from which consciousness develops. And here consciousness is the primary mind. It's just the initial lighting up of the object, the illumination of the object, without any sort of attitude or detail. So, sparsha. Sparsha gives rise to vedana, although, as I've already pointed out, this is a little bit complicated because samnya also can come in quite quickly. But let's just deal with it like that and cope with the simplicities of life. Vedana is usually translated as sensation or feeling. But the primary issue with vedana is hedonic evaluation. It's fundamentally what vedana is about. It's about the experience of something as pleasant, painful, or sort of neutral, somewhere in between. Although you remember from Know Your Mind, Banti points out that neutral, he doesn't think there's ever really a fully neutral vedana. It's more sort of dilute or even attenuated, even a bit, you know, failing to fully experience. But yes, vedana is fundamentally an experience of the object as painful, pleasurable, or sort of muddy and grey in between, neither one nor the other. It's, of course, mediated by the six doorways. So you've got painful and pleasant vedana associated with the eye, with the ear, with the tongue, and so forth. All of the senses, including the mind, especially the mind, give rise to vedana, give rise to painful and pleasurable and neutral sensation. But there's a primary distinction made in classical analyses between those vedanas that are to do with the physical organs and those that are to do with the mind. And in fact, they're given different terminologies. So pleasant, painful and neutral physical sensation are sukha, dukkha, and upeksha. And pleasant and painful mental sensation or mental feeling is somanasya and dominasya. So more happiness and unhappiness, or sorrow and joy, something like that. So that our physical senses deliver us, as it were, a raw experience of pleasure or pain. At its most sort of basic, somebody hits you, you experience pain without even thinking about it. You don't need to know who's hit you or what it is that's happened. The pain is immediate. And it's, of course, more subtle and complex with some of the other senses, but perhaps particularly the eye sense. But sukha, dukkha and upeksha as physical sensation are of this kind. They're just delivered immediately by the senses. But dominasya and somanasya, happiness and unhappiness, mental pleasure, mental pain, are much more complex. So it's not necessarily that the object directly delivers us pleasure or pain. It's often by association. So, for instance, you see something, which, you know, a brick fell on your foot yesterday. When you see that brick today, you're reminded of the pain that you experienced yesterday, and you sort of experience it now. So that you then think of that brick with a certain amount of disapprobation. Sorry, it's not a very good example, is it? Of course, it becomes much more complex and pertinent where people are concerned, because all the time people are giving us dominasya and somanasya. Some might think it's more dominasya than somanasya. Some might think more somanasya than dominasya. But every person we meet, to some subtle degree, sparks off an association in us. And that association will be tinged with hedonic tone. And of course, it's very, very often very adventitious. It's sometimes just to do with, well, skin colour even, or hair colour, or accent, or the way they stand, or where you met them. All those sort of things tinge your experience of somebody. And what I'm really trying to get at is this is primarily a mental phenomenon. It's thought into our experience, if you see what I mean. And you can think of so many other examples, I'm sure, in so many different ways. Everything that we experience in the mind has some subtle degree of hedonic tone to it. It's pleasurable or painful. And, of course, sometimes it's pretty neutral, it's pretty weak. But there's at least some residual element of that, at least according to Bhante in his interpretation. So all the time, we're evaluating our experience spontaneously as well as in quite complex mental formulations. We're all the time evaluating our experience. We're all the time saying pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain. And it so easily then, of course, goes on to like, dislike. So this is Vedana. It's said to have two, be sort of categorized or evaluated itself in two different ways. First of all, it's evaluated as contaminated or uncontaminated. That is, contaminated or uncontaminated by kleshas, and especially the kleshas of clinging. So we can have a Vedana, we can have a painful Vedana even, but we don't have to cling to that or even react to it. We can see it as it really is, not react to it. So in that case, it will be uncontaminated. But if we have an experience, for instance, of pleasure, well, we're likely to connect that with craving. And so we contaminate it in the traditional analysis. We contaminate it with craving. Those things that are painful, we contaminate most readily with pain, unless we have got some pretty sophisticated variations on Vedana. So contaminated and uncontaminated is a sort of broad categorization of Vedana, according to whether it's associated with craving and hatred or not. A lot of our ordinary experience, of course, is very much bound up with craving, albeit quite subtle. But especially, for instance, aesthetic experience, in the sense of an aesthetic experience which has no attachment bound up with it, and meditative experience is uncontaminated. You just see the object, and you enjoy its pleasurable characteristics without a sense of clinging. And in fact, the sense of clinging destroys the pleasure and destroys the aesthetic or jhanic experience. So we can classify Vedanas according to whether they're contaminated or uncontaminated. We can also classify them according to whether they are subjectivistic or transpersonal, in Gunther's terminology, which I think is quite good. And what this really boils down to is a more subtle and deep analysis. Is the Vedana associated with self-cherishing? Is it associated with, in traditional language, the view of Atman? Are you appropriating the experience to yourself? Are you experiencing it from your own point of view in a subjectivistic sort of sense? And this, of course, goes much deeper than the contaminated, uncontaminated analysis, because you can have an uncontaminated Vedana which is subjectivistic. So in other words, a jhana is uncontaminated because there's not clinging, or at least only very subtle clinging, but there is still a subtle selfish point of view, if you see what I mean. This is quite important in the whole Yogacara analysis, well, in Buddhist analysis generally, that we make a distinction between those things that are straightforwardly skillful and unskillful because they're associated with craving and hatred, and those things that are more or less ideal, you might say, because they're connected with a self-view. So dhyana takes us to beyond clinging, but it does not in itself destroy self-view. And our spiritual efforts have to be taken on to another level with vipassana. So the subjectivistic Vedanas are those Vedanas that are connected with clinging to self. Transpersonal Vedanas are those that are unconnected with clinging to self. They are, if you like, the Vedanas of a Bodhisattva. Presumably they would also include your feeling, the hedonic experience you'd have at other people's suffering. So you would experience other people's suffering not from a subjectivistic point of view. You would experience it as, objectively, in the same way, presumably, as you'd experience your own. Well, not directly, because it's not going to come to you through the same immediate channels, but your relation to it would be fundamentally the same. So that's Vedana. It's classified in terms of pleasant, painful, and neutral sensation. It's experienced through all the doors of the senses, and it's experienced especially on the physical plane and on the mental plane. It can be evaluated in terms of whether it's contaminated or uncontaminated, contaminated by the kleshas, that is, and especially by clinging or craving. And it's the dhyanic and the aesthetic and the dhyanic that, to my mind, represent the uncontaminated forms of Vedana. But then it can be classified in terms of whether it's subjectivistic or transpersonal, the transpersonal being that which you begin to have once insight has arisen, once you've begun to go beyond your own self-clinging. So what seems to me deeply significant about this particular analysis is that it emphasises to us that every moment of consciousness has Vedana implicit in it. We're all the time evaluating. Every second of the day, every moment of the day, we're evaluating. And I think it's very, very important to realise this. I found this a very, very helpful sort of perspective because it just rammed home the extent to which the objects of our senses and of our minds are arousing feelings of pleasure and pain in us. Of course, sometimes you get a bit numb. You've had too much pleasure or too much pain and it all gets a bit numb. Or if you live in a very intense sensory environment, you get a bit numb. You don't really sort of fully experience your sensations in the sense of your Vedanas. But nonetheless, even then, they're there. It's just that you're not really able to be sharply enough aware of them. And as I say, I think what's most interesting is that all the time we're evaluating people. And often that evaluation is sort of spontaneous. It's unthought out and even unconscious. We don't make it conscious. We're not aware. And it can be very adventitious facts about them, like, you know, the shape of their nose and accent, or, you know, as I say, the circumstances in which we meet them, all sorts of things, or a manner, whatever it is, can just arise within us the feeling of painful. That person somehow is associated in our minds with pain, perhaps coming from the past, whatever it is. And, well, that then leads into our relations with them. And of course, the same goes with pleasure. We often evaluate people very much on superficial grounds. I remember Bante emphasizing this to us when we were starting to discuss ordination requests. He was sort of pointing out that so much of what people were saying was, I like him, I don't like him. He gives me pleasurable feelings, he gives me painful feelings. That's all they were saying. They weren't saying whether he was ready for ordination or not. In Bante's usual rather blunt way, he pointed this out to us. So we need to really be much more conscious about our Vedana. Yes, Vedana gives us information, but it is not it's not necessarily objective or accurate information. It's simply information about what we feel. And we need to make that more conscious. We need to be more aware of the extent to which we're just reacting to our environment on the basis of previous conditioned patterns and saying like, dislike. There's a lot in the Pali Canon on this whole subject of like and dislike, which I found, again, rather salutary. And it's quite useful just to watch yourself through the day, you know, guiding your life on the basis of likes and dislikes. Of course, you can't leave it out of account and you have to work with it. But the danger is that you sort of base your objective, pseudo-objective judgments on the basis of on likes and dislikes. So it's extremely important to become more conscious of Vedana and to not react to it. In Know Your Mind, Bante has a very useful discussion of this question, that the difference between the reactive and the creative mind is that the reactive mind simply craves the pleasant and hates the painful. The creative mind takes whatever the Vedanas are and rises above and beyond them. So we need to be careful not to react to our Vedana. And you remember in the Wheel of Life, Vedana is the end of the Vipaka process. And it gives way to Trishna, which is the beginning of the Karma process. So we need to be careful not to just react to our Vedanas. We need to be aware of them and respond to them creatively. And that, of course, makes an important point, that both Sparsha and Vedana are Vipakas. We can't help that things are associated with pleasure or pain for us. We can help whether we react to that. We can't help that certain objects are illumined in consciousness for us, at least, you know, once we turned our eyes that way. But we can stop ourselves from reacting. So these first two, Sparsha and Vedana, are karmic. The remaining three are vipakic, if that's a word. The remaining three, Samnya, Chetana and Manaskara, are karmic. So, Sparsha is that basic contact, the raw contact between the organ, the object, and the consciousness. Vedana is the hedonic response to that contact. Samnya is something like perception, sometimes even translated as conception, but it's more recognition, interpretation. It's more a matter of recognizing the object as being something in particular, interpreting it in the light of our previous experience. It's distinguishing its own characteristics and fitting that into our pre-existing body of knowledge. There are two primary characteristics to samnya. There's first of all apprehending or perceiving the distinctive characteristics of that particular object. So it's discrimination. It's seeing that object as something with its own particular characteristics which is different from other objects. So we particularise it, we sort of box it off and I identify it as something in particular. Then we devise and produce names and concepts for it. I'm following Xuan Sung here. We having distinct, you know, made it distinct and separated it off and characterised it, we label it. We say what it is. And that, of course, means fitting it into our pre-existing pattern of knowledge, body of knowledge. Now, I've talked about it so far in a relatively sort of simple way. You know, we're doing it all the time. We look at things, we recognise them by their characteristics. We see them as distinct from something else. And we then give a word to it, which labels it. Microphone, whatever it is. But, of course, that process can become extremely sophisticated. The whole business of ratiocination is really the sophisticated elaboration of samnya. So, you know, finely spun philosophies, in the end, are versions of samnya. They're more and more sophisticated and subtle interpretations of our experience. And in the end, samnya is essentially the construction of our world. The construction of our world in accordance with certain views and ideas, concepts, labels, and so on. So this all comes under the heading of samnya. Now, samnya is classified in three primary ways. First of all, it's classified as accurate or inaccurate. Our samnya can be more or less in accordance with the real nature of our experience, so that if we're samnya-ing accurately, there's a coherence between the names that we give to things and those things themselves. We call it a microphone, not a lollipop. So you know, we can apply samnya to our world around us in an accurate way, in a way that conforms to its conventional nature. But then we can classify, and of course we can make mistakes. So we can be accurate or inaccurate in our samnya-ing. But then samnya has depth to it. There are levels on which we can samnya in the sense of being closer and closer to the real nature of the object. So this is usually classified in terms of the three levels of wisdom. So, shruta mayi prajna, samnya in this sense, is where we're simply able to use concepts accurately, use words accurately in accordance with conventional understandings. So when we label something, when we name something, it's what that thing is, conventionally speaking. So we've learned to accurately identify things in terms of our own language and culture. Chintamayi prajna is where we begin to penetrate a little deeper into the nature of the object in reflection. So we are able to identify the object as being whatever it is, but we also understand, at least conceptually, something of its deeper nature. So, for instance, what's usually said is we understand its relativistic and impermanent nature. So when we see the object, we're able to label it, but we're also able to identify it as something that has no perduring existence. So here we're able to apply the truth, at least through reflection, at least through conceptual processes. And samnya, this is samnya in this sort of deeper sense. But of course it goes further to bhavanamayi prajna, where we're able to see not merely what the object is in its conventional sense, we're not merely able to understand its the nature of its reality in conceptual terms, we're able actually to see what that object really is in reality. So what this tells us is samnya has depth to it. We're doing it all the time, and we can do it accurately or inaccurately, but even if we're doing it accurately, we may not be doing it deeply. We may not be really perceiving the true nature of the object. So developing samya implies developing wisdom, prajna. We'll see that this theme, this thread, is picked up in the Vinayata Chaitadharmas. Then finally, and this I find the most interesting dimension of samya, samya is experienced on different levels in terms of different worlds. So they said there's a samya that corresponds to the karmaloka, a samya that corresponds to the rupaloka, and a samya that corresponds to the arupaloka. Well, I think you could better say that the karmaloka is a certain mode of samya. It's when we perceive things from the point of view of our physical bodies and their needs. So that the karmaloka is where we interpret our experience from the perspective of our sort of physical material existence and identity. So we're in the karmaloka as long as we primarily identify ourselves and our experience in terms of our material identity and the needs that go with that, especially the need for its survival. The rupaloka is where we identify ourselves and our world primarily from the point of view of dhyana, whatever that may mean, from the visionary or imaginative dimension, let's say, even the aesthetic dimension, where we're not primarily concerned with ourselves or the objects of our perception as physical entities. We're concerned with them in their deeper reality. If you like, in Platonic terms, you're experiencing not the object, but the idea of the object, or the form of the object. In more Kantian philosophy, we're dealing with the pure object, not the object as perceived under the headings of space and time. Then, of course, the arupaloka takes that one stage deeper. I needn't try to flesh that out, particularly as I don't know how to. But we can see the sort of the implications of this. What's implied is that the movement from karmaloka to rupaloka is a shift in perspective, in interpretation, you could say. And I think this is followed through in the movement through the through access concentration into full concentration. It's as if to begin with, you sit there and you're experiencing your breath. Very much as a physical being. And the breath is a physical experience for you. You are sort of still identifying yourself as predominantly a physical being. You've probably got in your mind a sort of subtle kind of picture of yourself sitting there. And even when you're following your breath, you've probably still got a subtle picture of your body with the breath moving up and down within it. But as you focus on the breath, you begin to let go of the, as it were, constructed elements in the experience. And you begin to experience the pure sensation. And you experience it more and more from an aesthetic point of view, just as pure sensation. You're no longer subtly thinking, my breath, my body, in, out. You're just experiencing that sensation. And the more deeply and fully and purely you experience that sensation, the more you shift from the karmaloka into the rupaloka, because there's been a shift of samya. This, at least, is my interpretation, and I found it especially helpful in trying to deepen meditation practice. What you're trying to do is stop experiencing things as a sort of solid, fixed, material entity, with all the needs and desires and fears and so forth that go with that. You're trying to experience things in an absolutely pure, even raw way. Raw is not the right term because it sounds crude, but subtle way. And therefore you have a very pure experience of the object, and a pure object implies a pure subject, so that your experience of yourself is radically shifted and made subtle by that experience of the pure object. So, all of this seems to be what's implied by the idea of samnya operating on different levels. And it implies that this can be going on even within the Kamaloka, as it were. You can have more or less exalted samnya within the Kamaloka. I was thinking of that well-known saying of Blake's, that what do you say when you see the sun? You say when you see the sun, I see a golden object the size of a guinea. I say I see a host of angels crying, holy, holy, holy. That must be a difference of interpretation of samnya. That if you see it just in its mundane aspects, in its from the point of view of ordinary worldly existence, as it were, you miss a deeper and more imaginative and more beautiful dimension to it. So we've got these three levels we've got three kinds of analysis of samnya. Samnya being our basic interpretation, discrimination, labelling of our experience, which can be very, very sophisticated indeed. That can be accurate or inaccurate. It can be closer to to reality or further away. And it can function on different levels in terms of the lokas. And again, it's important to realise that we're doing it all the time. We're recognising, distinguishing and labelling. And our recognising, distinguishing or labelling, well, we have to face the fact, could be accurate or inaccurate. It could always go deeper. If we were prepared to reflect more fully on our experience, we would go deeper into the real nature of what we were experiencing and would interpret it, so to speak, on deeper and deeper levels. In the end, of course, the deepest level of samnya is not really samnya at all. It's not interpretation, it's direct experience. And we could be experiencing on more higher and subtle levels than we generally do. As I said yesterday, we probably put up with a relatively crude and coarse level of experience much of the time. And with a subtle shift in samnya, we could alter that. For instance, if you just go around all the time bothered about yourself and your own experience and whether people love you or hate you or, you know, whether you've been honoured or not or accepted or not, well, you'll have one kind of experience. If you go around thinking about other people and thinking, kindly of them, well, you'll have another kind of experience. And those are two kinds of samnya. If you go looking for the truth in things, the beauty in things, well, you'll have a different kind of experience if you go around looking for what you can get out of them in a purely immediate sense. So, we need to be aware that we're samnyaing all the time, and our samnyaing could be better. We can work on it by making it more accurate, by getting closer up to the objects of our perception, and by seeing them on higher levels. So, we've dealt with sparsha, vedana, and samnya. Now we come to chetana. Chetana is volition, but not just in the sense of our immediate sort of conscious will. It's the movement of the whole mind towards the object. It includes the unconscious and instinctive. It's our general drive or motivation, which moves us forward towards the objects of our experience. It's the drive that causes our minds to involve themselves with and apprehend their objects. We apprehend things because we're driven towards them, as it were. And, of course, chetana can be classified in terms of skillful, unskillful, or neutral. Again, we need to realise that every moment of consciousness has a direction or drive. Drive is intrinsic to consciousness. We're never completely still until enlightenment itself ensues. The apranihita is, so to speak, the transcendence of chetana. The direction of samadhi is the transcendence of chetana. Yet every moment of consciousness has a direction and a drive. It's said in the tradition that the mind is hungry. It's always looking for something to eat. It's always looking for something to involve itself with. And sometimes you can get a very vivid experience of this, your mind searching something to involve itself with, craving some involvement. Often, of course, it's because, you know, one's trying to meditate or whatever, and one's chetana is not subtle enough, so it won't engage with the object of concentration. So it craves something more raw, more coarse, to engage itself with. So it's important for us to really connect with the fact that we're always desiring, we're always moving. And of course that movement is driven by very complex and deep forces, a lot of which we don't really know about, or which we can never directly experience, we can only infer. Of course we can make them fully conscious in that sense. So it's important that we understand this, because chetana is really the key to spiritual life. The harnessing and directing of chetana is the key to spiritual life. If we can be motivated towards towards the three jewels, well, everything will follow. Going for refuge to the three jewels is a manifestation of chetana. Dhammachanda is a form of chetana. All the skillful and unskillful chetadharmas that we'll look at after Friday are forms of chanda. Anything that has an ethical tinge to it is a form of chetana, sorry. And we'll see tomorrow the first of the Vinayata chetadharmas, chanda, is a form of chetana. So getting chetana firmly in our sights, understanding chetana, is the key to spiritual life. And being able to work skillfully with our own chetana so that it moves in the direction we want to go, towards the three jewels, is the art of spiritual life. And there's no use just sort of pushing ourselves. Those deeper drives will react. And it really is an art rather than a sort of matter of giving military commands. So chetana is the general drive towards the object on all levels. But it doesn't finally engage us with the object. That is done by the fifth and last of the Sarvatraga chetadharmas, manaskara. Interestingly enough, manaskara literally means mind-making. And I think it means mind-making because it's manaskara that finally clinches the deal, so to speak, brings everything together in a moment of attention. That's probably the best translation of manaskara, attention. It's the conscious apprehension of an object. Albeit momentary, but one's mind is, for that moment, fixed upon the object. It's clarified in consciousness to a greater or lesser extent. So it's the final act of grasping the object in a moment of conscious attention. So everything that's gone on before that is sort of preliminary. There's first of all the raw contact of organ and object and sense consciousness. There's then the hedonic tinge. There's then the interpretation. There's then the movement of the mind towards the object. There's then the moment of conscious attention, which completes the whole process. In some Abhidharma systems, in fact, manaskara is replaced by chitta itself. So it's clearly meant to be the capping edifice, capping element in the whole edifice. It brings everything together. It brings all the five, all the other four chaitadharmas together with the primary chitta, as well as whatever other chaitadharmas have become associated with it. So it brings it all together, clinches it. It's a little bit difficult to really quite grasp what this means, but I think here we have to recognise that we're dealing with an analysis where you can't actually find the different elements necessarily. Some of them you can identify more clearly than others. Manaskara is analysed as wise or unwise, yoniso or ayoniso manaskara. Wise in the sense of being in accordance with reality. Unwise in the sense of not being in accordance with reality. So ayoniso manaskara is an act of conscious attention which focuses on an unreal object, an object that doesn't actually exist. So, for instance, you might focus on the speaker and decide that he's a complete idiot. Well, that would be an unreal object. I've got to try, haven't I? You come to certain conclusions, you come to certain evaluations, you get put certain associations onto the object, and you get it wrong. So, of course, at a more superficial level, you identify it wrongly. You think it's something other than what it is. You give it characteristics that it doesn't really have. You identify it with pleasure when actually it gives you pain, or it gives you as much pain as it gives you pleasure. You distort the pleasure that it gives you and focus on that at the expense of the pain, or vice versa. And you identify it ultimately as real and permanently existent. You give it own being. You see it as existing from its own side. So that is ayoniso manaskara, that you pay attention to an unreal object or to an object that is mixed up with unreality. And it's interesting it's put that way, because we sort of think in terms of an object out there which we perceive or misperceive. But actually what is in our minds is an object which is misperceived, if you see what I mean. It's not really what's out there, if there is anything out there. I'm not here in all this discussion, I'm not going to deal with any refined ontological issues. But yes, it is true that what we actually hold in our minds is not in accord with the way things actually are. So, to that extent, it's ayoniso manaskara. Well, this is pretty fundamental, isn't it? And of course, what we're trying to do is make our manaskara more and more yoniso, more and more wise, more and more real, more and more in accordance with the way things are. But we'll begin to see the implications of ayoniso manaskara as time goes on, because all of the various kinds of unskillful chaitta dharma are the results of ayoniso manaskara, because we've paid attention to an unreal object, an object that does not really exist, and we've accorded it a spurious existence. So that is manaskara. Of course, it's usually just reasonably momentary. We do hold attention on something for a while, but then we move on to other things, and it can be more or less momentary. But when we do sustain manaskara, then it becomes samadhi. Samadhi could be defined as sustained manaskara, where we hold our attention on a particular object. So, there we are. We've dealt with the five omnipresent chaitta dharmas, no doubt rather rapidly. But I hope that gives you at least some working basis for understanding them. I think probably with all of this material you're going to need to do reading outside and reflection outside, but I think there's a value in having it all presented as a whole, even if you can't take it all in. And I think that when one presents it in brief, you do get a total picture that is difficult to get when you're looking at everything in detail. So these five omnipresent mental events are processes underlying every moment of consciousness. They're all of them there all the time. And that, to me, gives us three especially useful lessons. We're always evaluating hedonically. And that hedonic evaluation is a vipaka. In other words, it's not something we have to take direct responsibility for. It's not something we have that much choice about. It happens. We just sense that something is painful or pleasant or is going to give us happiness or unhappiness. And that's going on all the time. The more conscious we make our own responses, the less we will react to them. But if we just live our lives in accordance with our Vedana, well, we'll be driven by our likes and dislikes, which will lead us into a great deal of unhappiness. And probably a lot of other people into a lot of unhappiness too. Secondly, we're always interpreting our experience. All the time, we're fitting what we perceive into the categories of our thought. And that thought is more or less accurate, it's more or less deep, and it's on a more or less high or low level. So we could certainly all the time be making an effort to raise the level of our interpretation, so that we're trying to perceive things at least from the higher reaches of the karmaloka, we couldn't be walking around, I don't think, in Guyana. As much as possible, trying to sort of penetrate behind the surface of things to what they really are. Then finally, we're always moving. We're always going towards things. Chetana is always driving us. And we need to be very conscious of that and try to make that chetana more and more skillful and allow ourselves to be, as it were, driven by in a positive direction. It's said that chetana is skillful when it follows the 10 kusala kamapatas, the 10 skillful ways of acting. It's unskillful when it breaks the 10 precepts that we take at ordination. So it's by practicing the precepts primarily that we get a grip on our chetana. But of course it's a much more complicated issue than that, because chetana isn't just a sort of a neutral energy that we switch on and off. We are chetana, so we have to want to go in that direction. And the art of spiritual life is getting us to go, as it were, where we want to go. So we need to be much more conscious of these three processes in particular. And that will enable us to give wise attention to the objects of perception so that we see them as they really are. So this is the basic lessons that come out of the consideration of the five Savatraga mental events. Every one of them is neutral. It can be positive or it can be skillful or unskillful. Well, in a sense, the Sparsha and Vedana cannot be skillful or unskillful because they're Viparkas. But they can be related to skillfully or unskillfully, and the last three can definitely be skillful or unskillful. It's by working on them that we can develop our consciousness to a higher degree. And we'll see tomorrow just what that means, because the Vinayata Chaitadharmas really amount to the process of turning the volume up on consciousness, turning it up so it becomes lighter and lighter, so that it is more and more lofty. So that's all for today. Tomorrow we'll be looking at the Vinayata Chaitadharmas, if you want to read up on it. And tomorrow we'll be also using the Vinayata Chaitadharmas as a basis for reflection and meditation. Tonight we'll be having a confession puja in which there's an opportunity to make confessions. And I presume that, you know, as a result of facing this sort of material, well, one will begin to notice lapses, and one will begin to experience some remorse. One will begin to realize one's consciousness is not as bright as it should be. It's not as lofty as it should be. It's not as skillful as it should be. So it's quite natural that one will want to confess. And, of course, the afternoon sessions are a good opportunity for that. But in the puja as well, there'll be an opportunity for writing down and burning confessions. So once again, I've managed to do it in exactly on time. So at 12 o'clock, we'll gather in the shrine room.